You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember those commercials during last fall's election season? Specifically, remember actor Michael J. Fox speaking out in support of candidates who support stem cell research? And you can actually see his body being racked by twitches and tremors of Parkinson's disease, a disease he feels could be cured by the controversial research. Today, you have celebrity patients that are commonplace, like Lance Armstrong's Live Strong campaign, or you had, remember, Katie Couric's televised colonoscopy to raise awareness of the disease that killed her husband. But it wasn't always that way. There was a time when famous people weren't as willing to go public with their private struggles. All that has changed with the media's unquenchable thirst for celebrity scandals and scoops about their private lives has come increased coverage of their illnesses. And the celebrities have learned how to turn this attention away from themselves and toward the support of their causes. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look at some famous patients, consider how sick celebrities affect our own experience with the disease and even the practice of medicine. That the spotlight is now on a lot of these famous celebrity patients. What do you think about these diseases? Have they affected your thinking and maybe possibly how your doctor practices medicine? We're going to try to separate the myth from the truth. For example, did Lou Gehrig bravely accept the reality of his fatal illness, or was he really misled by his doctors about his seriousness of his condition? We'll talk about where the public versions of some celebrity stories of illness leave off and the actual events begin. What is the truth behind these stories? So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Baron Lerner is the author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients, and How We Look at Medicine, published in 2006 by the Johns Hopkins University Press. He is Associate Professor of Medicine and Public Health at Columbia University Medical Center, Mailman School of Public Health here in New York. He joins us today in our Science Friday studios. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Lerner.
Thank you, Ira.
What made you decide to write a book like this?
Well, I'm into celebrities as much as anybody, I guess. And I got some foundations that pay me to read People magazine. The celebrities, I think, really have increasingly played a very important role. I think even as a practicing physician, my patients now will come in and ask me, do I know the certain treatment that a given patient got because they're famous, and that's what their reference point is for this particular disease. And as a historian, I thought it would be interesting to go back and trace when did this all start and why is it that celebrities have been willing to go public and why we listen so closely.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about when did this all start. Who was the first famous celebrity? Lou Gehrig?
Well, Gehrig was certainly one of the first, and I start the book with him because his story is so interesting. Gehrig got sick, as most of us know, in the late 1930s with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, now known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And then by 1939, he was very, very ill, but still trying to play baseball, but clearly was not functioning well at all. And his eventually, Gehrig went to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and that's where he was diagnosed with ALS. But what was interesting is that Gehrig's disease and his was announced to the public. So Mayo Clinic issued a press release when Gehrig was diagnosed and said Lou Gehrig of the New York Yankees has ALS, and that was broadcast on radio and appeared in newspapers across the country. Mm-hmm. And that was different. It wasn't in many, many cases, if a famous person got sick, the last thing that would happen would be the hospital issuing a press release saying what the disease was.
Mm-hmm. And you raised the question of whether Gehrig was told that his disease was fatal or if the prognosis or if that prognosis was avoided, as you say, was common at that time.
Gehrig, it's actually a very poignant and sad story. Gehrig was told that name of his disease, and if one looked at neurology textbooks from that era, one would have found that the disease was uniformly fatal. Gehrig latched on to a statistic. Somebody told him that he had a, quote, 50-50 chance, and nobody quite knew exactly what that meant. Was it 50-50 chance of living, of not getting worse? But what clearly did happen is that Gehrig pushed his doctors at the Mayo Clinic and really wanted to know, was he going to die or not? And those doctors, in cahoots with Eleanor Gehrig, Lou Gehrig's wife, never told him the truth. And they continued to harbor hope that he was going to get better. And as you say, Ira, that was very common in that era. It was a very paternalistic era in medicine.
And even the team didn't believe at some point that he was really sick.
Exactly. Everybody had a theory. I mean, people thought since he was the Iron Horse, he'd played in so many games, they figured he was just exhausted.
Right.
They thought he was in a slump. Gehrig didn't even after he took himself out of the lineup in the beginning of May of 1939, he didn't even go to the Mayo Clinic until June. So that was how people were trying to deny what was going on.
Mm-hmm. From the time of Gehrig until about, let's say, 1970, there were several already famous celebrities who got sick and went public with their stories. The movie Brian Piccolo's illness at the end of this period. Was it handled very much the same way as Lou Gehrig was?
Brian's song is a very poignant, again, another very poignant story that people certainly from my generation remember. This was a made-for-TV movie about Brian Piccolo, the Chicago Bears running back, who got a very rare, what's called a germ cell cancer, mm-hmm. and died in his 20s. And people remember the movie because the movie had this beautiful music and it was a very sad movie and it was this young man dying and he was the first person to room. He was white and he roomed with Gail Sayers, who was African-American. And if you watch that movie, there were certain things about it that were very progressive. For example, they talked about cancer openly, and this was the late 1960s and early 1970s, and that often wasn't done. But the real story behind Brian Piccolo was quite different than the movie. In real life, he had underwent several surgeries before he died. He was in tremendous pain, and it was very different than he looked. If you see the actor James Caan in that movie, he looks pretty good until the end. His hair is there and everything. And so it was really the Hollywood version that people learned.
Mm-hmm. You write that about this time around 1970 was really a turning point in medicine. In what way?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at Piccolo's story, it shows you how things were changing. Brian Piccolo and his wife, who I got to interview for the book, they never questioned the doctors at all. Brian Piccolo's chief surgeon was a football player too, and they were going to beat this thing together, and they were a team and all that stuff. In retrospect, though, Brian Piccolo's wife, Joy, said, you know, they wish they had questioned the doctors. They wished that they had asked if the surgery was really going to be worthwhile. And that was the questions that people were really beginning to ask in the 1970s. And the Piccolos weren't able to ask it. They were just in their 20s. They were hit like a ton of bricks. But other patients very, very shortly began to question their doctors and really ask what was being done and why it was being done.
I guess the most famous case of that was the Steve McQueen case, right?
Steve McQueen didn't listen to his doctors like Brian Piccolo did. He actually did at the beginning. He got mesothelioma, a cancer of the lining of the lungs, in the late 1970s. And he was a young man as well, in his 40s. He did get standard treatment initially, which was radiation treatment, and then was basically told by the doctors that it was inoperable and he was going to die. McQueen refused to accept that. And in the book, I almost argue he became one of his movie characters, where he was going to rebel and not take the word of the authority figures. And he went down to Mexico and underwent this very, very unorthodox treatment involving enzymes and minerals and even coffee enemas and this very sort of outrageous treatment. And for a while, they did a radio interview with him, and he said he was recovering. And people
he
put
had
a lot
people,
of...
He lied. He had people lie for him. You write in the book.
Exactly. Yeah. So he...
He denied everything.
He initially denied everything. When they found him down in Mexico, he said he was getting cured. And that misled people as well, unfortunately.
But it also, because he went to Mexico and talked about these alternative treatments, you now had a turning point in medicine where he would be an advocate, or you had celebrities, advocates for alternative treatments that other people had never heard of. Right?
Exactly.
The doctors had never told them about these things.
Exactly. And so, the doctor certainly never said it. And here was Steve McQueen, this famous guy who must know what he's talking about, going down to Mexico, maybe getting better. So it turned out to be, in a sense, even though McQueen died shortly thereafter, he was like a hero. And he had sort of outed this other world of cancer treatment that other very, very sick cancer patients tried to emulate.
And of course, right before Steve McQueen was Morris Abram. Not many people heard about him or know of him, but
Morris Abram is a more obscure celebrity, as my wife kept telling me as I was writing the book. But Abram's story I wanted to include because he was a very well-known civil rights lawyer who was diagnosed with leukemia in 1973. He was already in his 50s. And this is sort of the exact opposite of Brian Piccolo, where the Piccolo said to the doctors, you tell us what to do and we're going to be good. Abram challenged his doctors. He learned, for example, about some experimental immunological treatments for leukemia and basically sort of bullied his doctors into giving him these experimental treatments along with his chemotherapy. When Abram recovered from his leukemia, he was quite sure that it was his insistence and these experimental treatments that had cured his disease. And there was an article on the front page of the New York Times that announced this.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Dr. Baron Lerner, who is author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. Give us an idea today how it's so much different than it was back in those days. Well, give me you look at Lance Armstrong.
Lance Armstrong's a great example. Lance Armstrong gets sick with very severe testicular cancer. What Lance Armstrong does is he becomes a consumer. So he investigates getting treatment in Texas first, says that's not what he wants, that's not good for him, eventually winds up at Indiana University, gets treated, obviously does incredibly well, and then says, I have a duty almost to tell the public about what I did. I was so successful. Not just testicular cancer patients, but cancer patients in general, and sets up a website and a foundation, and now is probably the most famous cancer survivor in history. And he really did it. I mean, it looks good for him, but he really believes, I think, and is performing a public service.
I remember back in the days when AIDS, before AIDS was called AIDS, called GRID, you couldn't talk about it because it was such a stigma. But now we have celebrities who have changed that.
Very much so. If you compare, for example, Rock Hudson with someone like Magic Johnson.
Exactly.
When Rock Hudson was diagnosed with HIV and AIDS and died of it, nobody knew. I mean, that was the last thing Rock Hudson was going to tell anybody because it was stigmatized and was in the closet as far as his homosexuality. Now you've got someone like Magic Johnson who presumably got the disease from heterosexual sex and has done a great job surviving the disease, who's out there talking about it every day and serving as very much as a role model, trying to get teenagers not to have unprotected sex and to alert people about the treatment options and to get tested. So it's quite a change in AIDS too.
Now, you've researched all these famous people. Have you taken away any lessons about how that's impacting the public and its perception of diseases and from the celebrity influence?
I think one of the important lessons for doctors, for example, is to realize that your patients are going to hear these stories and know these stories. And they're often going to think that these stories are the representative ones for them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if someone develops Parkinson's disease, they're going to be very interested in what Michael J. Fox has done for his disease. What medications has he taken? Same thing with Lance Armstrong. Lance Armstrong writes on his website that people are constantly sending him letters saying, tell me what chemotherapy you had and what doses you had. And both Michael J. Fox and Lance Armstrong are very careful to say, look, we're not saying you should take the same drugs as us. What we're saying is we're going to tell you our stories and then try to take this knowledge to your doctors and talk about the treatment options. So there's pros and cons to these stories.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Baron Lerner. Dr. Baron Lerner is author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jason in Sacramento. Hi, Jason.
How are you gentlemen doing?
Go ahead. Thank you.
I wanted to stress a couple of key points. You guys are doing a wonderful job today. How are you gentlemen doing?
Go ahead.
We have to ask you to turn your radio down. Jason, turn your radio down.
I can hear you.
I know. I can hear you too well. I can hear your radio too well.
Points here that I'd like to go over too.
Well, I have to drop him because I couldn't understand. He broke rule number one of talk radio, which is to turn your radio down. Are more and more celebrities now apt to come out with diseases that they might be afraid to talk about?
So I think celebrities, it's almost become what we might call a duty when you're a celebrity, if you get a disease, to think about becoming a role model, someone like Pamela Anderson with hepatitis C. You just read almost every day someone with a given disease is coming out. We've got to be a little wary, though, I think. There actually are agencies that exist that connect celebrities and diseases. And these sometimes are diseases that the celebrity hasn't even had. And in a world of celebrities, I think there's not only altruistic motives, but there might be some financial motives as well. And I think we have to be a little careful when celebrities become spokespeople for various treatments and ask just what the information is that they're using to make such recommendations.
You know, one celebrity that you did not mention in your book, but for a slightly different reason, but I think had a tremendous impact on the future of diseases, was Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis single-handedly raised billions of dollars to create a research foundation that actually found the genetic cause of certain types of muscular dystrophy.
Jerry Lewis is a very, very important player here. He obviously himself didn't have the disease, but he became a champion of the disease. And I will tell you that in that era, it was very uncommon for celebrities to do anything like he did. Some of them would come public with their own diseases.
Or with hospitals like Danny Thomas at St. Jude's and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. It was in the early years where celebrities said, look, because I'm famous, I can get attention to these kids. And these kids' parents can go on the radio or they can try to make waves. But unless you get a famous person there, no one's going to pay attention. And now they would.
Mm-hmm. Do we see any more of these celebrities coming out, not for their own, but for other causes? Or are we mostly seeing celebrities talking about their own diseases because it's more of a personal?
There's both. I have a list that I accumulated of people who have talk about diseases that they haven't experienced themselves. I think one actor, I can't remember who it was, is a spokesperson for febrile neutropenia, which is a low blood count you get when you're getting chemotherapy, and he is being recompensed by the drug company that makes this. And it turns out, I think, a family member, a child of a friend, had this disease. And again, he chose to lend his name to it as a way to publicize that disease.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones again. We're going to have to wait because we have a break coming up. So I'll stay on the line, Steve, and we'll get back to you after this break. I'm talking with Baron Lerner, who's author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients, and How We Look at Medicine. We'll talk about what you think about celebrities and maybe how they've affected how you look at medicine and how you've asked your doctor. You know, there's this campaign that doctors have. Ask your doctor if you've seen a celebrity and say, I want what he has or what she has. How has your doctor reacted? 1-800-989-8255 is the number. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. With me is Barry Lerner. Dr. Lerner's author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. And he's associate professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University Medical Center and the Mailman School of Public Health here in New York. Brief program note on Monday, Neil Conan talks with playwright David Mamet, his new book, Bambi vs. Godzilla. It's an unfair fight. Pulls back the curtain on the absurdities of the movie business. That's on Talk of the Nation. On Monday, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lerner about celebrity patients and how we look at medicine. Any one celebrity patient that is unusual or stand out from the crowd strike you when you were doing your research and writing the book?
Well, one we didn't talk about was someone who was not a celebrity at all until he became sick, and that's Lorenzo from Lorenzo's Oil. That many people have seen the movie.
Right.
It was quite an incredible story in which the parents of Lorenzo, having found that their son had been diagnosed with this terrible neurological disease, adrenoleukodystrophy, went out and actually discovered what we now know is a preventive treatment for this disease and prevents boys from getting it. The parents, despite opposition from the medical profession, went to the library themselves, brought together all the researchers, and made this quite remarkable insight. Now, the movie isn't exactly accurate, and as you might imagine, there's some myth associated with that. But the parents really did that, and I really look at that story as the quintessential example of what we might call patient autonomy, of mm-hmm. patients and parents doing absolutely whatever they could, despite whatever the doctor said, to learn about their disease. In a sense, it's very much the opposite of Lou Gehrig or Brian Piccolo.
1-800-989-8255. Talene in Alaska, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call. On that very note, taking charge of your illness is what I did when I found out I needed a liver transplant 5.5 years ago. And it was during the same time that Mickey Mantle and Larry Hagman were going through the process of their liver disease as well. And when I was diagnosed with hepatitis C way back, it was not even referred to as hepatitis C. It was non-A, non-B. And hepatitis C and liver disease was brought to the forefront with a different light by Larry Hagman and Mickey Mantle. And Mickey Mantle was quite frank about the fact that he had gotten liver disease from his drinking over the years from cirrhosis, but that liver disease was caused by a lot of things. The celebrity status thing kind of worked for me there, but I in turn took everything that I could learn about my illness. My daughter was a biology student at the time in the university, and I wrote a book entitled Hurry Up and Wait, which is coming out in its second edition this year, about going through the transplant process. I then became the celebrity, and people wanted to hear my story. And so what I think it boils down to is the identification process, like Lance Armstrong, for example, saying that he has an obligation to do this now. I feel exactly the same way. I had a tremendous support system and an insatiable desire to learn what I could about my illness, and so hence the book. And that's, like I said, what turned around. And so now I am in this situation where I'm offering my story to people, and people are buying my book because of the fact that they can identify with it. I really appreciate this discussion. It's a great one, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Stephen in Palo Alto. Hi, Stephen. Sorry to keep you on hold.
Oh, that's all right. There's such a stigma on mental illness. I'm wondering if Dr. Lerner has any examples of celebrities who've got some publicity for mental illness.
Thank you for asking. The one story I particularly talk about in my book is that of Jimmy Pearsall, which certainly the baseball fans would know here. Jimmy Pearsall had what we now would call bipolar disease in the 1950s. And boy, if you think cancer was stigmatized then, you're absolutely right. Mental illness was incredibly stigmatized. People associated it with institutions and lobotomies and all sorts of seemingly grisly treatments. Pearsall went public with this. He wrote a book called Fear Strikes Out that was made into a well-known movie with Anthony Perkins and talked about it frankly. And I read a bunch of letters in my research from people with mental illness who wrote to Pearsall and just were so incredibly grateful and said, I never talked about this with anyone, but because you've brought this issue to the public, I feel like I can talk about it with people.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, he was. I remember growing up as a kid, you know, people thought he was just nuts. They would say he's spraying the outfield with, you know, insecticide to keep the bugs out, things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, the line sometimes in his case, he was sort of a character, and the line between actual mental illness and sort of a quirky personality was unclear at the start. But certainly by 1952, he'd gotten so much worse that he was institutionalized and got the diagnosis.
And I would imagine right now depression, because there's so much diagnosis, there should be a spokesperson, you would think, right? A celebrity for depression.
Yeah, a number of people have talked about their depression openly. Yeah. Mike Wallace, most recently Brooke Shields and postpartum depression. But I'll tell you, and they've done it very eloquently, but depression remains something that I think there's an unfortunate public perception that people just need to snap themselves out of. And I think that celebrities have done a good job of saying why this really is a disease. It's an abnormality of the chemicals in the brain. but certain things remain, carry certain cultural representations, and they're hard to break.
Of course, you need the gatekeepers to allow this information a lot of times. I'm thinking like the Oprah Winfreys who have these special programs.
Absolutely. The role of the media has been foremost. And, it works in both ways because the media like to bring celebrities on because people watch the show. But then the celebrities benefit because Oprah Winfrey and other people in the media will have them on. So it really becomes a great way, as that previous caller said, with respect to Mickey Mantle, it just becomes a great way to get information out there.
Mm-hmm. You say a central idea in this book is how we establish scientific proof in medicine. How does that idea play out in these cases that you write about?
Well, one of the interesting developments in medicine that's gone along with this rise in celebrity medicine is something that's almost the opposite, and it's what we call evidence-based medicine. You should never make a medical decision based on a specific case. You should only look at randomized controlled trials and very sophisticated scientific studies among populations. And don't you dare do what your sister did because it may have no relevance to you. What I try to argue in the book is I think we can use both of these models. I think it's important to look at the data that we generate from very, very sophisticated studies, but the stories are important to people too. And if Lance Armstrong survived his cancer because he did this, it provides an inspiration to people. And they may not want to do exactly what Lance Armstrong did, and their cancer may not be identically the same, but following in his footsteps symbolically, if not exactly from a medical perspective, becomes very important for people who are sick.
You know, there was a news story this week, yesterday, about autism, how much autism there is. And you have had celebrities like Don Imus, people like that, who've been screaming about this for years. Do you think that finally, that wheel was creaking enough now? It got oiled finally after all these years of celebrity status?
I think so. The people who've been trying to publicize autism have been using all the strategies that the earlier celebrities have mastered, which is go into Congress. When I listen to Imus, there's a couple of Congress people that are very involved in this, wealthy donors, foundations. And the idea is you get everybody from Hollywood and Washington on the same page and then get some money in there, and all of a sudden the disease is on the front page of the New York Times as it was today.
Mm-hmm. Cole in Buffalo, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about treatments, and I was wondering if this celebrity effect in medicine would be just as influential when involving prevention measures such as in the case of lung cancer, or even to the same effect, global warming?
Good question.
That's a good question. It's always harder to get someone to come up to prevent something because how can you prove that they were prevented from having a certain disease? When you got cancer and you're cured, it's easier. But I think it's a great question, and it's something that celebrities might play a larger role in. One of the good examples that Ira mentioned at the beginning of the show is Katie Couric, who urged people to get colonoscopies because her husband had died of colon cancer that might have been detected that way. Other celebrities have gotten very involved, for example, in mammograms and early detection in that manner. And so it certainly is another possible option for celebrities to try to get us to prevent disease, stop smoking, for example, in addition to curing diseases that are already there.
Thanks for calling. It's funny about the Stop Smoking campaign because the campaign we see goes back to the 40-year-old idea of showing the black lungs and things, not a celebrity spokesperson.
Although there were a couple early celebrities who did that. William Tallman, if people remember from the old Perry Mason show, and Yul Brynner, both of them were dying of lung cancer and made these public service announcements that are very haunting but very moving, in which they urged kids never to start smoking.
Mm-hmm. Jim in Sebastopol, let's go. Hi, Science Friday is waiting for you. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, I was thinking about FDR and the state secret basically of his polio, but then the March of Dimes and all the publicity of that just from his what he accomplished and what he did with the disease he had.
Good point.
You bet. FDR plays in a bunch of different directions in the story. And one thing is the polio, as you mentioned. In the sense, he was extremely open about the fact that he had polio. On the other hand, he concealed the extent of his polio throughout his presidency, but was very, very instrumental in getting his friend Basil O'Connor to start the National Foundation, which obviously eventually led to the successful vaccine. A story that people know less well about Franklin Roosevelt is that he had severe hypertension and congestive heart failure in his last years in office and may have been impaired, but that was kept completely concealed from the public as he was running for election for the last time in 1944.
And in those days, the press cooperated. Concealing a lot of
absolutely.
Not never showing him, you know, on his crutches or things like that.
And they did, the press never questioned the very marginal reports from the doctors that he was doing fine when he clearly was very sick.
Well, did they do the same thing with Lou Gehrig? I mean, in those days, baseball writers were very friendly and supportive.
Yeah, the Gehrig story is interesting because Gehrig is better friends with a lot of the sports writers than with his teammates. And he used to play cards with them on the train. And they were some of the first people. He wasn't holding his cards right and he couldn't deal the cards. And they were among the first people to figure out something was wrong. They reported the story when Gehrig was doing okay at the beginning after his diagnosis and he was in an experimental trial. When Gehrig got sick and they knew he was dying, they clammed up completely and didn't write about it anymore. They didn't want Gehrig to read about his own deterioration in the newspapers. Very mm-hmm. touching.
Mm-hmm. Talking with the Baron Lerner, author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Rich in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Rich.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
I wanted to just bring up a point. I've noticed one of the obvious consequences, I suppose, of celebrities coming out and speaking about a disease is that there's a considerable amount of research dollars that then end up going to helping that disease. And unfortunately, those dollars are often taken away from more serious diseases. For instance, in the case of AIDS, I mean, we raise, you know, considerable amounts of money to find a cure for AIDS, and yet lung cancer, which kills far more many people, seems to get less of the research dollar. And I was wondering if Dr. Lerner could comment on that.
I think that's a great point. Many times when I've given talks in public, people have come up to me afterwards, and they're lung cancer activists, and they bemoan the fact that I've talked about all these diseases where there's these well-known celebrities, and there's no celebrities for lung cancer. And you're right. I think a reality of American society is that the people who scream loudest get the most dollars. And I think that activists for AIDS and breast cancer and the other diseases that have been very successful would argue that they're trying to expand the whole pie and not take money away from other diseases. But I think if you look at how disease research dollars are advocated, it would not line up directly with the mortality. It is based partly on who the celebrity of the moment is and whether or not they've gone to Washington, D.C. to lobby.
Thanks for calling. Are any celebrities prodded by their public relations people saying this would be good for your career? You know, this.
I think so. I don't think they talk about it very much, yeah. But I think it's seen as a good move if you're willing to do it. You know, some people who are fairly, I guess we might call B-list celebrities, you know, the guy who played Squiggy on Laverne and Shirley got multiple sclerosis and, you know, wrote a book about right. it. And, you know, I don't really question his motives, but, you know, it probably, you know, I think career-wise it was a way to get back into the spotlight. So, I think that celebrities, are like all of us, are motivated by both self-interest and altruism.
And sometimes it can backfire. Look what happened with the Rush Limbaugh case. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're referring to the Michael J. Fox thing,
his own problems.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he, you know, I don't know the degree to which he wanted that story out there,
right.
But I mean, his, you know, to the degree that he was addicted, I think there wasn't a lot of sympathy. And again, it's almost like the mental illness thing.
Right.
You know, is addiction a disease or is it a personality flaw? And the larger point, I think, is when you go public, you don't necessarily get to manage how that story is going to get played, and different people mm-hmm. can spin it in different ways.
And taking that step further, the Michael J. Fox case with Rush Limbaugh backfired on
Rush Limbaugh, where he saw Michael J. Fox campaigning openly for stem cells and therefore liberal candidates, and Rush Limbaugh really had the audacity to suggest that Michael J. Fox was exaggerating his symptoms to get sympathy. And that, you know, I had researched a whole book on this for years and years, and I took a gasp when I heard that. I couldn't believe that somebody would say that. I mean, obviously Limbaugh's passionate about his politics, but Michael J. Fox was just a sick guy desperately looking, I think, for new and interesting and innovative treatments and was looking wherever he could on the political mm-hmm. spectrum.
And Rush had the bad judgment of parodying him on his own website with his own webcam.
Exactly.
And making things even worse.
Exactly. Right? Just a bad move all around, I think.
I guess what goes around comes around
yes.
in this business. Well, I want to thank you, Baron, for taking time to be with us. A fascinating book. It's When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. Baron Lerner, who is an associate professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University Medical Center, Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Thanks for taking time on your book tour to drop in with us here on Science Friday.
Thanks a lot, Ira.
You're welcome. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers in New York are Neil Rausch and Josh Rogerson. Also, we'll have thank Manoli Weatherall. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarian Key Molesky. If you have comments or questions, write to us the classical mail way, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can leave us email at our website, sciencefriday.com. Also, we are podcasting and blogging there, and Science Friday's Kids Connection, free teaching materials we make out of all of our programs. Also waiting for your suggestions for how we might improve our website. So give us a little visit at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.